So as we start, Exodus is an absolutely amazing book. And our theme on this Bible study series and next comes out of Exodus, called out of captivity. We are called out of captivity. And of course, the whole story of the book of Exodus is how God called Israel out of captivity. So the book of Exodus, the book of Genesis, ends with the Hebrew word Mishraim, which means in Egypt. I was telling my wife this morning, I love Egypt's, the word for Egypt in Hebrew, Mishraim, miserable. I always think of miserable, that they're miserable in Egypt. This connects the book of Genesis. A couple of Bible study series ago, we studied Genesis, and this connects Genesis. The title, this is just free, the title of the book of Exodus in the Hebrew Bible are the first words in that book. And so the title of the book in Hebrew is, "And These Are the Names Of." And so if you're ever on Jeopardy, you can answer that question. What is the name of the Hebrew Bible in the Old Testament? And it's typically the first names, the first words in the book, with the exception of Numbers. Numbers is a little different. That one is in the wilderness. Okay, that's enough. Let me share some idiomatic expressions. Now, the reason I wanted to share these is that for us, and we're not Egyptian, we're not Israelites, and we weren't living in the time of Moses. And so this would mean a little different to us, but for them, these would be statements that connected how God phrased things with what how the Egyptians understood words. So it was their common vernacular that God took over and showed his power even through their language. So the first one is a strong arm. Exodus 3, 19 and 20 says, "However, I know that the king of Egypt will not allow you to go even under force from a strong hand. But when I stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the miracles that I will perform in it, after that, he will let you go." Stretch out my hand, that strong arm, that strong hand that's represented in that verse. The pharaohs would say that they had a strong hand. And one of the things that Moses communicated, at least to Israel, that the strength that the pharaohs had was insignificant to the strength of God. And one of the ways that God would demonstrate that would be the ways in which he led the people out. So I'm going to pause here and ask, how did God lead the people out of Egypt? What did he do? He parted the waters. Yeah, Red Sea. Even before that, how did he lead them out? The plagues. What did you say? He went before them. Okay, so I'm going to start with the plagues. The plagues were a 10-step systematic demonstration of the power of God. That was his strong arm. And he went before them, not only in preparing their release, and we know that because they left well off, financially well off, better than they've ever been. And that's a whole different story, that God gave them everything they needed to build the tabernacle and get ready for that worship and entering into that relationship with God is an amazing story. But it's with a strong arm. Why would that be so significant for those who are led out of captivity, that you're being led by someone with a strong arm? Think about the ways in which that would help, especially while they were still being pursued going through the Red Sea, hearing Pharaoh's armies behind them. What separated Pharaoh's armies from the Israelites as they were going across the Red Sea? The pillar, God's presence, his strong arm. Isn't that wonderful? There's another expression I wanted to give you. When accounting the plague of the hailstorm, there's this phrase, such as never been before in Egypt. What are some of the phrases that we hear in our society that talks about greatness? What are some of the phrases we hear?
Awesome.
Awesome? Yeah. Unprecedented. This has never happened before. Unprecedented. Yeah, anything else? That would be something like that. This is something that has never happened before. And while we may think that that is an exaggeration, it was a fact, because God actually said, and when he says it, it's always a fact. But it's also... it connected with the Egyptians and the Israelites. Pharaoh Moses III would pronounce that he has done something greater than all the things that were in the country since it was founded. And so that was a phrase that was common. The name of the Egyptian god Ra and the name of evil is the same. I love that one. That's fantastic. I'm gonna go through these structures pretty quickly. I think they're in your notes, but I want to point these two out first, and then we're gonna slow down on the third structure. There are various structures in Exodus that compares Moses to Israel. Moses was born a slave in Egypt, and Israelites were born slaves in Egypt. How long were Israelites in Egypt? 400 years. Yeah. And so Moses undergoes a water ordeal and is delivered. What was that water ordeal for Moses? You can tell by the reference. The basket, yeah, he was drawn out of the water, and that was the origination of his name, actually. He was drawn out of the water. And why was he in the water? Why did he have to escape? Hey, Susie, welcome. I know you don't want to be pointed out, and I just did that. Please don't forget to get something to eat. So... Pharaoh's wrath, the most powerful man in existence in that time and in that country, wanted the male babies dead because of the growth of the Egyptians. And he murdered them, right? And God protected Moses. Israel undergoes a water ordeal in the Red Sea, and God again protects him. Pharaoh wanted them dead, and God protects them. So you can just see that. Sinai. You can see God appears to Moses in a theophany on Mount Sinai, and God appears in a theophany on Mount Sinai to Israel. And in both cases, there's fear. Stay away, you know, because of the power of God. All right. Moses hesitates and doubts, but God is faithful. And in Numbers, Israel, in the Torah, in the five books of the Old Testament, it shows Israel constantly being unfaithful and God being faithful. I'm going to pause here for a second and say, is that something that phrase, unfaithfulness for our part and faithfulness to God, is that a message that the people we serve can hear, and would that be a benefit to them? Isn't that wonderful that every time we talk about that and we see that, even in the book of Exodus, we can point that out and say, see, this record was preserved for us so that we can see the character of God. And God's character doesn't change. He's a merciful God. He's a God who on purpose called people to himself. And he knew the people he called to himself. And yet he still loved them. Okay. So those are structures. Let me quickly, any thoughts before I move to the next one? Anything that comes to mind between Moses and Israel? Let me move on to Exodus and Matthew. There are parallels between the book of Exodus and Matthew too, so as you study, you can bring those out. And one of the benefits of that is there's a common thread between the Old Testament and the New Testament. While we make a division between Old and New, God didn't. What he built and unveiled truth throughout the Old Testament. And that is often repeated in the New. So let me give you an example. Genealogies in Exodus and in Matthew. How many of you really read all the genealogies rather than start at the beginning and then go to the end? Oh, so I'm not even going to ask that. I mean, remember? So most of us, when I'm preaching, I read all of the genealogies. When it's devotional, I glance and I skip because they're names I don't recognize. But why did God give us all those names? Why was that necessary? People are important. They were real people in real situations. And there's also, within those names, you can trace the Messiah through those names. It's fantastic. God's faithfulness screams throughout. And people that you wouldn't expect and shouldn't be there. So that's wonderful. So when you go to Exodus and see Matthew, you can see some correlations. Jesus flees to Egypt. Moses flees from Egypt. Pharaoh kills male children. Herod kills male children as well. All right. So this is where I want to spend a little bit of time. This is going to be fun. There is a correlation between the days of creation and the plagues of Egypt. Now, I've given you the first one on Genesis 1. Talks about light out of darkness. And the ninth plague, darkness prevailing over all the land. So what you're going to see in this is that what God established as an order, he used that as a punishment against sin. And as an example of its power over the gods of Egypt. All right? And I'm not going to talk about the gods of Egypt, but let's just pause for a second and look at. So day one was light out of darkness. What is day two in the order of creation? Waters, yeah, the waters were ordered and separated. Was there a plague that spoke to waters? Water turning to blood. Exodus 7, chaos by turning water to blood. Do you guys remember this event called, what was it, Helene? how many of you lost potable water during that hurricane? Okay, so we lost it for the first time. I've never been in a situation where I didn't have potable water. But we lost potable water. And it became clear to me at that time, water's pretty important. I knew that. You know, medically, you need water, but experientially, It was significant. Imagine living in Egypt and all of your water sources turned to blood. How does that demonstrate the power of God? Shows how much we need him. It's an everyday. I mean, we're used to praying the prayer that we pray on Sunday morning. Give us this day our daily bread. And so we acknowledge on some level that we need God every day. This was a great lesson on that, right? Yes. Ooh, that's a good one. Yes. So, like, what we did was we came down to the church and got potable water because it was water down here, but not in Egypt. Somebody else is going to say something. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the day one, light out of darkness. Day two, water and the firmament was separated. Day three, what was there? Yeah, dry land, land and vegetation. Oh, you have it in your notes too. I said, you're using the same words that I wrote down. That's right. I'm looking at the same thing. Okay, so dry land. What was the plague that corresponds with that? Yes, the destruction of all the vegetation. God created it and provided it, and he used a plague to destroy all vegetation. Here's another free one. In the book of Joel, the plagues that the locusts, instead of going against God's enemies, God used the locusts to judge Israel because he was trying to call them back. So God's judgment is punitive. God's discipline is always calling us back. And who does he discipline, according to Hebrews? Those he loves. Isn't that great? All right. So that was for free. Okay. So day four, creation out of the luminaries, the stars, the moon. What was the plague that related to luminaries? The darkening of the luminaries, the darkness. Again, in Exodus 10. So Exodus 10 corresponds with two of the days of creation. Two, darkness, underscored in this example twice. What's the significance of darkness spiritually? What does that infer or represent? Separation from God. What does light represent, especially as it relates to Christ? Truth. God, even in his character, God is light. He draws us to himself. So those terms can be sometimes used to invite people into not only a joy in their relationship with God, but those outside of the covenant of faith into a relationship. Okay, two more days. Day five, creation of birds, fish, and sea life. I'm not going to ask anymore. So what's the plague that relates to that one? Yeah, death of, well, I said cows, but death of fish and frogs. Plagues one and two. And then lastly, creation of animals and humans, and I heard this, the cattle, plague on insects, boils on beasts and on humans. And then finally, the killing of the firstborn. I'm going to compare what happened in Egypt to what happened in Judah. or in Palestine. The killing of the firstborn in Egypt was for what purpose? Judgment. It was God judging. It was God showing he had power over death. The killing of the firstborn in Palestine in the first century, what was the result of that? What was the purpose of the killing of the firstborn? Salvation. Jesus Christ was the firstborn. And so that those are ways in which we can connect Christ even to the stories that we tell over and over again. So when we get to the plagues, we can talk about God's power over the gods of Egypt. We can also talk about the blessings that are ours because the firstborn was killed. Any other thoughts about these before we go on? What time is it? Got to pick up the pace. Any other thoughts? What are themes? What are themes? Yeah, in general. Yeah, yeah, in general. Sorry. Truth that's
repeated throughout.
Yeah, yeah. So that's something that we look for to in a larger passage to say this is what's important. This is what we want to get. All right. So here are some themes in the book of Exodus. The revelation of God's name, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, in the Old Testament, when it says the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, there was a time when Isaac and Jacob and Abraham were living. And so it made sense that he is a God of. But throughout the course of history, biblical history, God is still referred to as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, after they've died, what is that reminding us of?
The covenant.
Death doesn't break that covenant. Isn't that wonderful? Is that something that can be an encouragement to the people we serve? That our worst enemy can't break God's commitment. I am who I am, the tetragrammaton. We right now in English, we refer to the covenant name of God by Yahweh. For Jewish brothers and sisters, they would use four consonants so that his name would never be mentioned, could never be uttered, because they wanted to honor the name of God. And that's where that theological term, the tetragrammaton, Yahweh. I am who I am. God is never not God, which is very helpful when we live in changing times and uncertain times, that God is never not God. That's a theme that flows throughout the book of Exodus. Where was his name given, the name I am who I am? When and where was it given? In the book of Exodus. To Moses. Yeah, yeah, by the burning bush. The God who is present. Okay, kingship. God as rescuer and ruler. Who talked about the staff? The staff, the cruelty. But God as a king, he rescues. He rules. He leads. He never forsakes. And I know I'm going out of bounds here, but when we go into the book of Numbers, that's what we discover with God in the wilderness. He is always with them. And how does God show up in the wilderness? He shows up by the pillar of cloud during the daytime and the pillar of fire at night. But he also shows up where else? Where? Yeah, in the tabernacle. That place, the place of worship that the, oh, I love this, that the tribes of Israel centered, surrounded, so visually God was at the center of their being. It's wonderful. And the tabernacle was to be removed and stay where Israel was. God's presence is amazing, his kingship. And the sanctuary or the tabernacle. The tabernacle was a tent of meeting where God met with Israel in his capacity as king. I love the way that Kosenberger and Goswell puts this. In his capacity as king, shown by the rich furnishings of the tabernacle. The furnishings of the tabernacle signify so many different wonderful truths. And one of them is we serve a beautiful king. He deserves the best. The beautiful draperies, the ornate furniture, gold. God deserves the best. And so the sanctuary, the tabernacle, God resides where his people are. So I'm going to, there's a tabernacle aspect in the first chapter of John. What is that tabernacle aspect in the first chapter of John? Oh, God tabernacled with us. The Word became flesh and dwelt with us. He made his dwelling with us. So when we get to the tabernacle, it's a natural reminder that Jesus Christ took on flesh so that he could dwell with us. He can stay with us the same way that he stayed with Israel in the wilderness. All right, any other thoughts or any other themes that you can come up with in the book of Exodus? Yes. This is what they did. Yeah.
Because you just don't really see that. You see the commands in our culture now, but you don't see us following through.
Yeah. Yeah. So here's something that can help us when we get to that point as well. He who began a good work in us will what? Isn't that great? That's the God we serve. I love that. All right. Incidentally, when Lauren made reference to the book of Leviticus, what she was saying, that's a fascinating book. It's really interesting. That's what she meant. That's what you meant, but all right, anybody else? Any other thing? Okay, let me talk a little bit about ethic. Ethic in Exodus. The word Torah, which is commonly translated as law, means teaching or instruction. So let me just pause there for a second. What's the difference between law and instruction? What is law? Rules you have to obey. I'll say it. What is a traffic law that you do not like to obey?
Speed limit.
Speed limit, okay. I didn't bring it up. That's their issue. Speed limit. There's a law, and there's a punishment associated with that, financial punishment associated with that. teaching and instruction. What does that bring about? What does that speak of? Learning, application, that God's teaching us, instructing us. Mary, you're going to say something. Yes.
Teaching you as you do it.
Yes.
Understanding why the law exists.
Yes. And so it is didactic. Is the best part of learning is when it's give and take. There's a question and there's instruction that God instructed his people. And he did that in the law. And when we look at the law as not just a set of rules, but a guide to teach us how to live, and here's the point, in front of a holy God. The God said, I am the Lord who brought you up out of Egypt. We're already free. We're already in a relationship. You're not earning anything with me. Now I'm going to teach you how to really live. So the ethic is divided into two different parts. The first is our relationship with God. Why in the world would we start with our relationship with God? Why is that necessary?
Everything else stems from it.
So let me just talk about some teaching in the New Testament. If I come to an altar or to a place of service, and I remember that I have something against someone, before I give devotion to God, what am I commanded to do? Go to them. All right. All right, let me give another example. By this, all men will know you're my disciples. God is related even in the ways that we relate to one another. Any other examples where that's significant? You can see it in Exodus, but also in life, where our relationship with God really is a foundation around which we live. Yes, Julie.
I think this question you might be asking, the law is just there. With learning, it's progressive.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The more I study, the more I see my own sin, the more I fall things. It's a progressive, and because that God loves me, he doesn't expect me to be a do not feel perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would actually say I would love it if you didn't kill. But anyway. I know what you were saying. I couldn't help it. Right, so let me say this. I am the Lord thy God who brought you out of Egypt. You shall have no other gods before me. Why would having no other god before God be significant in the way that Israel lived? What was God saying there? He's exclusive in devotion. He doesn't share his glory with anything else.
His name was I Am.
His name is I Am. Elohim is another that mighty God. Whoa! All right, let me just ask you. Did Israel have other gods? That tells me I have 20 minutes. So, did Israel have other gods? They borrowed them from the Canaanites, didn't they? All right, let's move ahead several thousand years. do people we live around, let's just talk about them, we're not talking about us, them, people we live around, do they have other gods? And what do they look like? Money, academics, power, influence, politics. Yeah. And that saying, that's a continual reminder that the way that I live my life has to start with my devotion to God, my worship of God. There's a beautiful picture of this in Genesis, where all of the beauty of life is surrounded by a relationship with God. And in my mind, it is in the cool of the evening, before the fall. What happened in the cool of the evening? That they walked with God. Adam, I was going to say Abraham, because Abraham's on my mind. Adam, and I was going to say Sarah. What's her name? Eve. Walked with God, right? And this is beautiful. When they sinned, where do you see God in that? He's searching. He's still out there walking. He knows where they are. And he brings them back. Isn't that great? The relationship with God. One more. Remember the Sabbath by keeping it holy. What is the blessing of the Sabbath? Not the regulation of the Sabbath. What's the blessing? I heard it, rest, right? Rest. So here's the truth of rest. I am not in charge. It doesn't depend on me. It depends on God. Now, there was a visual lesson given to Israel in the wilderness that brought that out. The 40 years they were in the wilderness. Remember that lesson in the manna? That God would give them twice as much as they needed so that they can honor the Sabbath and rest. On the other days, the manna would spoil, but God changed the chemistry of the manna on that one day so that they could rest. Pardon me. God gave a command and gave provision. And so can we still have Sabbath rest today? And is that still a blessing? It can be. Isn't that great? When we get to that, it turns the law into that teaching, that opportunity to remind us that God is significant. So let's go to the second part of the ethic, how we relate to one another. We already know that Julie will not kill anybody. But what are the other what are the other commandments, and why are they so important as it relates, as we relate to one another? Think about relationally, lying, bearing false witness, and how that can destroy. Think about coveting, how that can break down affection. Right? You have a neighbor, rather than take joy in the fact that I saw this morning our neighbor had a, what is that, electric car? Tesla. Thank you. A Tesla parked, and the first thing I thought of was, there's a Tesla over there. Boy, I'd love a Tesla. I'd love to drive one. I won't fit. I'd fit in a garbage can, the big one. I'd love it. Rather than, wow, isn't it wonderful that they can have a Tesla? Isn't it great? And God's given me a GMC. And I'm happy in my GMC. I actually love my GMC. But I am happy in that. In that, in this relating to one another. Okay? So the ethic of, yes.
One of the things that I never connected till just now is that
Isn't that wonderful? Anything else before we, let me see where we are. Oh, that's you. I don't have any other slides, but I want to refer to a couple of things on my notes. So I've given you, I was not working off of my notes, that's why I was trying to guess what was coming next. But I've given you a structure in the Old Testament. The Old Testament includes certain text types. I've given this to you when we studied Genesis. So I'm not going to go through it, but I'll point it out that the Bible is a piece of literature that God uses effectively to communicate truth. And in this section of Old Testament, history is primarily narrative. And so the forms of narrative becomes extremely important in bringing out meaning. And so some of the longer passages, it would be helpful to remember that there are characters, and there's plot. And if you want to get sections, you can get a whole section by starting with setting, conflict, climax, resolution, and new setting. And that's one of the ways in which you can get setting. And so remember that even as Moses wrote, he wrote in this literary form to allow us to enter into the text so that the meaning that we get wouldn't be just our meaning. It would be the meaning that God intended by following those rules. But as I close, I'm going to spend the most of the final time on teaching Christ from the Old Testament. I'm not sure which page is on your notes, but there's a crude drawing, page five. That drawing that reminds us that through every instance in the Old Testament, we can find either the anticipation of Christ as the people of God would look forward to a deliverer and the realization that Christ meets what was anticipated. So Christ becomes the deliverer, and we can point that out. We've already said tabernacle, God dwelling with man. We can point that out. The I am, the God who always was. At the beginning of John, again, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Even before there was a was, God existed. It's amazing. Right, all of those things that Christ, it points back to Christ. Why would we want to do that in our Bible studies? Why would we seek to make a connection? What do you think? Yes. Yes, it is real. Lauren. There was a time when my brother looked up to me and he said he thought I was the best mechanic. He really did. And so he proved that by saying, Ken, would you change the brakes in my car? And I said, absolutely, because I used to do stuff like that all the time. And so I took off a tire in his car and he's going, wow, yeah, because I'm smarter than he is. But anyway, I'm not. Anyway. And so I took out the caliper and I removed this bolt on the caliper and the caliper fell apart. My brother went, wow! But he didn't see the look on my face because my face was, I had never seen that before. It was, oh no, what do you do? God never has a moment where he says, oh no, I didn't know that was going to happen. Now, I'll tell you the rest of the story. I told my brother, I have no idea what I'm doing at this point, but we got it back together. All right? God's not like that. That's amazing. Praise the Lord for that. Anything else? I'll leave you with this. There are two questions that you can ask each passage to try to find Christ in the text. How will our teaching point to Christ? And how will our teaching provide a pattern for life for those following Christ? How does it point to it? Is there something in the passage that reminds us this is how we are to live? And we can live in Christ. We have been freed from captivity for real. And what does that look like?